to do that. All right, it is great to be back here in Wausau with you. I was here last 2 years ago. I was a speaker for Family Bible Week with the teens, with the students, and I've done that with that group at least three times, maybe four. I don't remember how many over the years. So it's nice to kind of graduate and be able to speak to the adults. So we'll see if I can keep this position or if I get demoted. We'll see. I want to take just a couple minutes. If you aren't there already, please turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 17 is where we're going to be spending our time this morning. But as you turn there, I just want to take a few minutes, please, and tell you about my ministry. This is not going to be an infomercial, but real quick, you need to understand what I do so that you understand where I'm coming from. Because if you don't hear the background, you're going to go, why is he talking about this stuff this week? What a weirdo. All right, so I have an organization called Addison's Walk Institute for Christian Studies. There's a display out in the foyer. And what Addison's Walk effectively is that I created my own missions agency. It's a 501c3 organization, and I am a missionary to college students in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And there are reasons, and I have a strategy why I started my own organization instead of going with a missions agency. Believe me, it would have been much easier to call, say, the Association of Baptists for World Evangelism and say, hey, can I be a missionary? They'd say, great, as opposed to recruiting and keeping board members and all that kind of crazy stuff that I have to do that I don't really enjoy. But there's a reason why I did that, and I'm not going to tell you all what that is. If you're curious, please ask. I'm happy to say so. But basically, what I do would be similar to what other traditional campus ministries do. So things like Campus Crusade, InterVarsity, Chi Alpha, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, perhaps what the Sturkins are now doing in Minneapolis. I'm not sure what organization they're with, but it wouldn't surprise me at all that they would be doing something similar. So the difference between what I do and what they do is that all those organizations are clubs that are sanctioned by the universities where they operate. That means that the people who are associated with those clubs can advertise on campus. They get to put their activities on campus websites and lists and bulletin boards, use the university logo. They're there. If the university likes them or not, that's beside the point. But they're at least sanctioned and they're allowed to be there. I cannot do that. Addison's Walk is not a club. We are underground. It's more like operating in the 1040 window. There are five colleges or universities within the city limits of Scranton. Scranton is not a very big place. It has more people than Wausau, but you have much cooler restaurants. We have no hoo-hot. And last night, I had the pleasure of eating at, what is it, Pizza Ranch? That was glorious. We don't have that either. So we have more people there than you do here, but we have five colleges or universities that total 10,000 college students. That is an unreached people group. Make no mistake. Many of the students, and I've had over 1,000 students come through my classroom in the past 5 years, many of them have, the first time they heard about a redemptive relationship with Jesus Christ was because I told them on the first day, I am a Christian. And that means I follow the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. He is my hope and he has my allegiance. The first time. We are underground. The two larger schools there that would support that kind of ministry will not, because they are Catholic universities, and they will not allow any outside organization. And if you're all upset about that, oh, how dare they? Well, imagine, say, Cedarville University having the Jesuit Club. They wouldn't do that either, right? So it's okay. No big deal. But I have access that those other organizations would die for. I'm in the classroom. I teach philosophy and theology at both Marywood University and the University of Scranton. I have anywhere from 27 to 35 students in each class, and we explore the fundamental issues of life. We look at them sometimes from a biblical perspective, because I do get to teach theology, and that's kind of cool. And you might also be surprised that we get to do those things in the realm of philosophy. Philosophy doesn't get quite as good press, but trust me, it's okay. It's a friend of Christianity. It's all right. And so we get to do that, and it's how I conduct my classroom, and some of the strategies that I use, that the students are coming to me and they're saying, please, can we talk more? It's awesome. So I'm not a missionary like the ones that I grew up with. I went to a Baptist church, and we had a missions conference that seemed like 9 times a month that lasted for 12 days a week. Can I get a witness? Anybody remember those when you were a kid? Thank you. I see that hand, right? And so they'd come pulling up in their 1968 VW Euro bus held together with Bondo, which would be cool today, right? But back then, as a kid, you're like, dude. And so they'd come in with their old carousel slides. Well, we're serving Jesus, but we're the saddest people on the planet. Oh, sorry, that's our family reunion. I don't know how that picture got in there. And there was the saddest people, and then we'd go home, and my mom would turn around from the front seat of the car. Don't you want to be a missionary when you grow up? No. Mm-mm. No, thank you. I do not want any part of that. And so here we are, crazy. And I am having the time of my life serving the kingdom in this capacity. So the last thing I'll say about being a missionary is this. I know when visiting churches, folks often like to see missionaries dressed in the traditional garb of the place in which they are ministering. You're welcome. I actually have another jacket with elbow patches on it, so I've been accused of trying hard to look like a professor. And so it happens. So anyway, all right, so that's it. So that's what I do. And if we have time throughout the week, if I can just share some initiatives and some things we're thinking of, if you're interested, that'd be great. And if we don't have time, please come see me and take me out for coffee. And I will gladly, if you ply me with coffee, I'll tell you anything you want to know. All right, so what we're going to be doing tonight, starting right now, tonight and through the rest of the week, is we're going to be looking at the two classic university passages that are in the Bible. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I took a seminary class on advanced sermon stretching, so here it is being put to use. But there's basically two passages that we can look at that we can really think about the university, and we can think about college students. Now, if you're worried, oh, this is just going to be for or about college students, you need to banish that idea. Yes, we will be talking about the contemporary university through the lens of Scripture, but the things we're going to be talking about are not things that only college students need to worry about. You and I must be worried, aware, and knowledgeable about the things that we're going to discuss for a couple reasons. One, it's going to help to develop our own life and godliness. It's going to develop some confidence in us about what we believe and whom we believe in. Furthermore, it's going to help us to be able to minister to that unreached people group who, if you haven't noticed, have left the churches in droves. Where are they? And you can read the literature that would say, well, all you need is to offer them relationships and have coffee that comes from some distant place that's really good. Well, those are kind of no-brainers, but that's not going to get you there. You got to have good coffee to attract millennials, right? If your idea is like, well, we got a fresh can of Maxwell House. No. You might as well sweep the floor and brew that. Okay? They would know the difference. Sorry. I love Maxwell House. I'm sorry. Don't be offended. So we're going to be looking at some of those things. And I will warn you now, we are going to span the range of literature, history, philosophy, theology, and we're going to try to understand some of these things. So let us talk about Athens, and the reason that we're doing this is because, ladies and gentlemen, the sad, cold fact is that about 40 or 50 years ago, the church en masse abandoned the university. The church en masse abandoned the university, and we put all of our eggs in another basket. Does anybody know or want to take a guess what that's called? By the way, I'm conditioned to have a conversation with my audience, so I hope that doesn't freak you out. Not. Better get used to it, because we're doing it till Wednesday. Anybody know what it was? Starts with a P and ends with olitics. Oh, yeah, politics, right? And how did that work out for us? We got exactly what we wanted. The fruition of all of it came to light in 1981. From 1981 to 1993, we got exactly what we wanted. Now, make no mistake, I've been to the Reagan Library twice. I love it. I get it. What changed? Nothing. What the church didn't realize, and I don't think she was trying to escape it, but just perhaps out of pure ignorance, what she didn't realize is that the ideas that come to us do not come from the halls of government. They trickle down from the faculty lounges, the classrooms, the administrative suites, the professors' offices of the university. So here we are. Acts chapter 17, we're going to begin at verse 16. This passage is a preacher's dream because it is broken up nicely into three sections. And I'm going to frustrate you, but I'm going to tell you right now that we're going to spend the majority of our time on the first section of this passage, and I'm going to sum up the final two because I'm going to make an assumption, and I could be wrong, but I'm going to make an assumption that you would be more familiar with the final two sections of this passage than you are the first. And the reason is because there are two words in the first section that we don't use very often in our contemporary language. And I've spoken in enough churches, and I've been doing this for enough years that I've come to realize that we tend to look at Scripture the same kind of way, where if we see words or names that we don't know, we skip over them because we're conditioned to be very pragmatic, right? And that's not bad. But we're conditioned to look at a passage and say, I don't know what those people are. I can't pronounce that name. Let's just get to what I'm supposed to do, right? Like, when's the last time your ladies' Bible study said, all right, ladies, we're going to get together and we're going to study 1 Kings, and we're going to study the genealogies in the beginning of that book. Nope, nobody really does that. Oh, look, names I can't even pronounce. How wonderful, right? Nobody does that. So we're going to spend some time doing it. Right, here we go. Chapter 17, verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, and the them is Silas and Timothy. So Paul is on a missionary journey. He has a stopover in the Ivy League city of Athens. While Paul is waiting for them in Athens, he is greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happen to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Did you hear the words that we do not use very often? Ding, ding, ding. There they are. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. My, so much in there in those first few verses. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at three ways. Okay, do I have it upside down? Yep, that would help. All right, can we forward that? All right, this want to be with Jesus, I think. Okay. We weren't sure it was going to work. All right, so we need to talk about Paul's strategy for ministry here in Athens. And Paul understood that there are necessary things for ministry and that there are sufficient causes for ministry. So just to give you an example, I told you a necessary cause or a necessary thing for working with millennials for college students is having good coffee. It's necessary. However, it is not sufficient to bring them to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, right? I don't care how good the coffee is, it ain't that good. Right? So it's sufficient. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. So Paul knew some of these things, and these are philosophical words. Well, Paul was classically trained. Paul was also from one of the other three of the Ivy League cities of the ancient Near East. So there's Athens, there's Paul's hometown of Tarsus, and the third one is Alexandria, Egypt. Those are the three. And if you're thinking, what about Rome? Not yet. It's coming. It's on the way. It's kind of the late addition to the Ivy League community, kind of like Johns Hopkins University. That came much later than Yale and Harvard and Cornell. So it's on the way. And Paul understood something about the difference between necessary and sufficient. I have a bunch of necessary things that are happening inside my material body that allow me to be standing before you. It is not just my skeletal system or my muscular system or my endocrine system or my central nervous system. All of those are necessary, right? But are any single one of them sufficient by themselves? No, they are not. They have to be working together. So there's this combination of ideas that Paul understands as sufficient in order to have effective ministry in what is a pre-Christian society. So we can make the connection with Athens as a pre-Christian society to what many would label today as a post-Christian society. They share a lot of the same ideas and values, and make no mistake, our universities by and large are like a pre-Christian Athens, except for now they are post-Christian, after Christianity. And so the desperate is real to bring it back, right? So let's talk about the three things. And the first thing is understanding. So if we go to the next slide, first click there, please. Let's talk about what Paul understood. First thing I want you to know that Paul understood is that he understood that everyone at their core is religious. Every person on the planet is a religious person. Let me take it a step further. Every person on the planet is a spiritual person. It always amuses me when I hear people talking about spiritual formation, and the gentleman, the deacon who made some announcements, I kind of get the impression that that's kind of something he's responsible for, helping you develop spiritually. And I always get a kick of when I hear sometimes people say, well, I look at this person and they're so much more spiritual than I am. That's actually impossible. You're either a spiritual being or you're not. Now, godly, that's a different story. So you haven't told me, you can say, well, I'm a very spiritual person, like the lady I sat next to on the plane who's going to come up again and again and again in this conversation over the next few days, because that was a God thing that I could not escape from her on the plane. And she's extremely religious, but she is so far from God. So see, if Paul were sitting next to her, he would recognize that she is religious. So if you see books, if you go hang out at the Barnes and Noble and look at their religion section, which, by the way, is not a bad idea to do, to see what is over there, and you see books that come from uber atheists like Richard Dawkins, the late Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Jerry Coyne, and on and on and on, who want you to think that you're an idiot if you have faith, if you believe in God. Well, the same could be true of them if they claim that they had no belief at all. Of course they are religious. Let me tell you what I tell my students and what Paul would have understood as well. Not only is every person on the planet religious, every person on the planet is a believer. I tell my students that, and I get the same reaction that I'm getting from you. Some of you are like, what? That sounds a little heretical. Good. I'm glad you caught that. Now, did I say every person on the planet is a believer, or did I say every person is a Christian? Is there a difference? Can they be the same? Sure. But not necessarily. Let me take it a step further, and I will tell you something that I do not tell my students. This would not go over well. Right now, in this moment, the cells and stalls of hell are populated with believers. Every person on the planet believes something. In our series that we'll begin tonight, we're going to be looking at four key areas of belief that every person on the planet has an answer to. They aren't necessarily correct, but they have to be able to somehow answer these questions in order to navigate life. Every person does. Paul knew that. Paul understands that everybody's a believer, that everybody, he even says in verse 22, I see that you are very religious, people of Athens. He understands that they are people of faith, that they believe in something that is beyond them. He understands that about people. So if we're going to understand a contemporary university ministry and understand who we are and just our neighbor, whether they have any identity with a university or not, the person who does not know Jesus, you have to stop and think that they believe things just like you. The question is, in whom or in what do they put their belief, and by what evidence do they have? And the same can be asked of us. You believe in Jesus based on what? Can you answer that question? Second thing Paul understood. Next click, please. Is that he was distressed by the idolatry. I want you to notice Paul's reaction here. Again, if we can go back to verse 16. While Paul was waiting in Athens for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. That word distressed is one of these rich Greek words that just you can spend hours reading about its nuance and how else it's used. It doesn't mean he was angry. It doesn't mean he was ticked off. It doesn't mean that he was about to write an encyclical called, all right, early church, here's what I want you to do. We're going to institute Punch a Pagan in the Face Tuesday because of the great idolatry across the Greco-Roman world. No, no, no. This is a word that if you can think of when you receive bad news and you're not expecting it and your heart sinks into your stomach. I served as a pastor of an inner city church in Scranton for 10 years. Scranton is the valley of the shadow of death. Those of you who have ever seen the NBC show The Office, you know at the beginning they have the little montage of Scranton. That is real footage. Apparently John Krasinski took it himself. That's the rumor. And you see the sign, Scranton welcomes you. I've often wanted to cover that with another sign that says, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. I think that would be a more appropriate introduction to the city. And people, horrible things happened. I performed both weddings and funerals as a pastor, of course, and I'm here to tell you, I performed far more funerals than I did weddings, and most of them were for people younger than me who died horribly. Drug overdose, suicide, two murder victims. I couldn't believe it. People who died of completely preventable diseases all the time. And so my phone would ring sometimes 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, I'm old enough, nobody's gonna call their pastor, hey buddy, just call and see how you're doing at 3. Doesn't happen. So when your phone rings and we all have phones, we know who's calling before we say hello. Back in the olden days, remember when you had to actually pick up the phone and find out who's calling you? Can I get a witness? Right. So you know who's calling you, and you know that the family's name, who you see on the screen, they have that loved one who's on the edge, and you know why they're calling you. The heart would just descend. It's the same word that is used of Jesus in Matthew chapter 9. As Matthew tells us that Jesus was moving through the villages and the towns, and he was going to the synagogues, and he was preaching the good news of the kingdom of God. And it says that he was greatly distressed to see that the people were harassed and helpless and like sheep without a shepherd. They could do nothing to help themselves. They were completely lost, and it broke the heart of Jesus. He wasn't angry. He was compassionate. So the next time you're cruising Facebook and the ubiquitous video making fun of snowflakes comes up and you get angry, I ask you to do something. Check yourself. And consider instead 2 Corinthians 4:4. Where Paul writes there, and he says that the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. They are dead men and women walking. That ought to break your heart, not make you angry. Paul understood that. Let's talk about another thing he understood. Next. Please. Paul understood the thought culture of the people to whom he's ministering. This is so important. A number of years ago, I read a little book by Francis Schaeffer. thinker from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, died in the mid-1980s, Presbyterian pastor. He and his wife, Edith, started Le Brie in Huemas, Switzerland, the shelter. It's French for the shelter. So that all the hippies that had nowhere to go to ask their questions, he said, you come to us and we will help you find the truth. And he wrote prolifically and he wrote prophetically, not because he said this is what's going to happen, but he had his finger on the pulse of culture and understood what was happening to it. Some of his books are fascinating. In the opening paragraph of the first book published under his name called Escape from Reason, he said this: if you in your churches have missionaries on the foreign field who are really getting it done, who are effective. They aren't just there collecting whatever in their compound, safely living apart from the people, but if they're really effective and you bring them home and you ask them, why is it that you are so effective? They're going to give you some of the answers that you would expect. Well, we speak the language, right? You would expect them to know how to do that. They understand the clothing. They eat and like the food. They understand the currency. All those things he said you would expect. And the one thing that you may not expect, but the one thing that is essential for them to have ministry is that they not only understand how the people talk, they understand how they think. They understand their thought language. Ladies and gentlemen, that concept for me in college ministry has opened so many doors because I work very, very hard to understand the mindset of a millennial. In fact, I have a whole seminar on that. I work very hard at doing that. Paul understood the thought language of these people. Now, it tells us, interestingly, that he is in Athens, and does he go to the First Baptist Church of Athens? Is that his first stop? Nope, why not? No church, right? There's no church in Athens. So he goes to the synagogue, because is Paul Jewish, yes or no? Yes, good, all right. So Paul's Jewish, so he belongs there. He knows the stuff, and he had some conversations, and he also talks to the God-fearing Greeks. And I really want to ask God about who they were. Someday, I'm just curious, like this category, I'm a little confused about that. But then it says he goes to, where's the next place that he goes in the text? The marketplace. That is the Greek word agora. That would be the Walmart of the first century. Right? So like today, I don't care who you are, you have to go to Walmart sometimes. Don't you? And isn't it kind of glorious that you can go to one place under one roof and you can buy a shirt, a car battery, and go to Subway? Isn't that glorious? Now, in Paul's day, he'd be buying a toga, a camel blanket, and going to Gyro Way, probably, instead. You just think about it. It's funny. Yep, all right. So he's there. And what does it say that he is doing? Verse 18. What is he doing? Or excuse me, verse 17. He's reasoning with them. And it tells us what he is saying in the bottom of verse 18. Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Now, this is where the confusing bit comes in. We meet these folks, the Epicureans and Stoics, and it says that they are confused. They began to debate with him, asking, what is this babbler trying to say? And that's not because Paul talked fast. They thought he was saying dumb stuff. You're a moron. What are you talking about? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but for a philosophy teacher like me, my geek alarms are going off. Because you know what I know? That's not the first time that phrase has been said in that place. But can I give you a little brief history lesson on the city of Athens? All right, Athens is a center of religiosity. It was burned to the ground in 480 BC by the forces of Xerxes. Finally got in there and burned it to the ground. The Persians were booted out in the Persian Wars, two main battles, one on sea called Salamis, one on land called Plataea. The Persians were sent packing, and the Athenians rebuilt the city as a monument to Athena, their patron goddess. And they didn't forget all the rest of the Greek gods and goddesses in the vast Greek pantheon that has now been absorbed by the Romans. So you have the Greek god Ares, who's now the Roman god Mars. And the conversation that Paul's going to have is on Mars Hill, right? So you have the city that is extremely religious. Even before the sack of the Persians, 100 years before that, it's a very religious place. And there's a guy who went around asking questions, and he went to the Walmart of the day, the Agora. His name was Socrates. And he went to the Agora and he said, you know, I got a question. He said, I know that for centuries we of Greeks have believed in this group of gods, a pantheon, Zeus, Apollo, Athena, Poseidon, my favorite, Hephaestus, because he made like shields and stuff. That's the only reason I like him. He's not real. I realize that. Just calm down. So he said, you know, and we attribute all the things that happened to these gods. And he said, you know what? Here's an idea. So he did the first century, actually 4th century BC equivalent of, I'm not saying anything, I'm just saying. And he said, you know, instead of all these gods, and if you read the Socratic dialogues written by Plato, particularly one called, I should have wrote that down. The Euthyphro, excuse me, the Euthyphro, where he says, the gods don't even get along. They change their minds all the time. We don't know what they want. And so Socrates said this in the city, said, really? There's a bunch of gods, they don't get along, we don't know what they want, and pleasing them, we're guessing. We don't know from one day to the next if they're going to bless us or curse us. We have no clue. And he said, and we got to figure out what holds it all together. And he said, you know, here's what I think. Instead of a bunch of gods who don't even have the same mind, like they don't agree on stuff, instead of that holding it all together, I think maybe it is one God who holds it all together. And Socrates and many philosophers that came before him, conveniently called the pre-Socratics, had a title for that. Would you like to know what it was? The Logos. Remind you of any famous passage of Scripture? John, chapter 1. Now, in the beginning was the Word, which is one of the translations of the Greek word logos. It does mean word. So in my Bible, the pages are filled with logoi, right? Multiple words. But Greek is a very rich language. Sometimes they have multiple words for one idea. Sometimes they have multiple words going in the opposite. Logos is one of those words. Yes, it does mean word, but it also means something else. It means the unifying principle, the thing that holds it together. You see, the Greeks were asking, how come we don't spiral off into chaos? Why is there order instead of disorder? Or in their words, why is there cosmos, universe, instead of chaos? Because they knew enough to observe the natural world and say, there's order, not disorder, and you don't get order out of disorder. You, the other way, yes, but how does that happen? What holds it all together? And so Socrates said, I think it is one God. I do not know his name. I do not know where he is. I don't even know if he has personality. 400 years later, John chapter 1, writing to a Greek audience. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And not anything that has been made was not made without him. He's saying, hey, Greeks, that thing you've always been looking for, I know his name. It's not a what, it's a who. I know where he is, I know who he is. And unlike your gods who don't really like you, this one became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And so Socrates, who suggested that it is one God, you know what happened to him? He got sentenced to death by a jury of his peers for advocating foreign gods. Not the first time. So here we have Paul, and he's got this group of people talking to him. All right, now we're going to explain, next slide please, we're going to explain Epicureanism and Stoicism really quick. Epicureanism is a school of thought that began in Greece, started by a guy named Epicurus, so that's convenient, about 300 years before the time of Christ. Now, these schools of thought, and we're just looking at two, there were many of them around, were asking basically the same questions, and that is, how do I live a good life What is a good person? Now, those are questions that Christianity answers, are they not? Yes, they are. But their answers were a lot different. So Epicureanism, their main tenet was, we want a life free of pain. Now, does that sound terrible, horrible, pagan, godless to you? No. In fact, it would not surprise me in a room of this size, somebody in this room woke up this morning, and after you were conscious and you started praying, said, oh God, would you please give me just a few minutes that are pain-free today? That's okay. And they wanted to do that by living a life that maximized pleasure. Now, is God anti-pleasure? Certainly he is not. But these were the folks who said, well, anything that we can find that's going to feel good, we're going to do it. So if they made t-shirts, it would be eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Now, by the time we get to Paul's day, 400 and so some odd years later, the Epicureans had turned into the massive party animals of the first century, right? They're the ones that you would stereotypically think are standing around, toga, toga, right? Or as Seneca the Stoic wrote about them, they ate to vomit and vomited to eat. They partied their faces off. And they were actually proto-atheists. They kind of wink and nod at the gods and say, okay. But they actually believe that everything in its makeup is material. They were called atomists. The word atom is a Greek word. It means a very small particle. Now, they didn't understand atomic theory like some of us in this room would, even close to it. But they believed that everything was made up of very small particles, including you. So when you die, all of your particles break down and they go back into this cascade that would go around and around and around. So they said, well, we need to avoid death because at death there is no more pleasure, there is nothing. So we need to get everything out of life now, party like it's 1999. And I have a modern day example of an Epicurean for you. That's Miley Cyrus. Now, I could have put anybody up there, but that'd be an example. So if in reading that word Epicureanism, you're like, ah, that's just old dusty dead dudes that have nothing to do with me, you're wrong. By the way, can we go back a slide, please? That, we just think of these guys as old dusty curtain wearers, right? That curtain wearer, that is Epicurus himself. Do you know it is Epicurus who codified what we know today as the logical problem of evil? You're like, Andy, I don't know what that is. Sure you do. It goes like this. How could a good God allow, finish it. How could a good God allow bad things to happen to that guy? 300 years before the time of Christ. So the logical problem of evil has nothing to do with us today, does it? Right. Of course it does. Okay. Let's go to Stoicism. All right, that curtain wearer, that is Marcus Aurelius, who came about 100 years after the time of Paul. We know a lot about Stoicism from him, founded by a guy named Zeno, all kinds of writing about Stoicism. And basically, their whole motto was, figure it out. And what they wanted was to have a life that lived in balance. And so they would teach that you, from your inner strength, you develop your own inner strength so that you can handle life. Now, they weren't atheists. They believed in God, that we have to put major air quotes, but their God was not a person. It was reason itself. Have you ever heard someone use language like they're talking about a situation that's going on around them, said, oh, I would never be involved with situation X because it is beneath me? Has anybody ever heard language like that? That it comes from Stoicism. They believe that you could pull yourself up above the normal and you could see life kind of pass below you as if on some kind of super highway or conductor, and you would absorb those things that would bring you closer to reason, and you would reject those things that you wouldn't, but you were in control. Here's my closest example of a modern Stoic. Now, if I were J.J. Abrams, I could... Thank you. I could have Yoda and Mr. Spock on the same slide, but I'm not, and I don't want the universe to explode. If you don't get that joke, you're missing nothing. But for those of you who are sci-fi nerds, you're so welcome. And the reason that they're confused is not because they're anti-Jesus and certainly not because they're anti-religion, if I'm correct in my response that the entire world is religious, right? The reason why they're confused is because neither one of them have a concept of resurrection at all. Stoicism and Epicureanism are ultimately completely hopeless. There is nothing. In my ethics class that I teach at the University of Scranton, I do a little mini course within the course where we compare and contrast the ethical systems of Epicureanism, Stoicism, and Christian theism. And I have a textbook that actually has all three of them in there, but I actually add another text for theism because I think the textbook's a little weak. It is a very ancient book that I bet some of you have heard of. It's called Philippians. Now, you don't need to know this to get anything out of Philippians, but I think Philippians is a frontal assault on Epicureanism and Stoicism. Why do I say that? Because Paul uses Stoic and Epicurean language in the book when he says, I've discovered the secret of being content. You know who would say that? The Epicureans. And he would say, oh, and FYI, it's not something that I develop, something that I make, something I create inside of me. It is given to me from the outside. It is the gospel. That is a secret of a content life. And my students read that and say, wow, he really seems to have hope. You think? All right. So now we're going to blaze through the rest here. And my time is nearly gone. I'm conditioned to speak in 90-minute time slots. I asked Pastor Rob, how much time do I have today? Oh, just go. No. Please. That's a mistake. That's bad. I'm like by myself in my office, so when I have an opportunity to start talking, I can't stop it. But I want to take you to the thing that you're probably a little familiar with, and if you'll forgive me and offer me some grace if I'm wrong, and you're not familiar with this, you tell me, and I will make it right. But they say, okay, we kind of want to hear more about this. So it says in verse 19 that they took him to a meeting of the Areopagus. Now, the Areopagus, if we're going to go with our university trope here, is that that's kind of like the faculty lounge of the University of Athens. That's where you'd go try out new ideas. Now, look at this. They took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, and they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? Remember, they have no concept. Pre-Christian society. These are not Sunday school guys. They don't know what a resurrection is. They don't really know who Jesus is, I don't think, at this point. You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Boy, does that sound like a culture you know. It's called Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, fake news. Pick one. It's amazing how fundamentally things do not change. Technology, of course, does, but the fundamentals do not. All right. So now Paul he's taking his opportunity. He stands up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. And as I looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. And I think it is so cool that you and I are both so extremely religious. Isn't that awesome that we can all find God in our own way? Wrongo! I find that you have an inscription to an unknown God, so you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. That's just hot. That he stands in and he says, you're wrong. You're ignorant. You've missed it, but I appreciate the fact that you're very religious. And you notice that it says that Paul carefully investigates the objects of worship. He doesn't say, I can't look at them. I can't be part of that. He puts aside any legalism that might be upon him. He says, I need to know. If I don't know, I cannot minister. That's why I read the bulletin boards, and I pay attention to what students are telling me. Is some of what I hear offensive? Oh, you bet. But I don't look at them and read those things and hear what they're saying, and I think, oh, you know how offended God is that you're saying those things? Because I know theologically, but just by nature of being born, like myself at one time, they cannot offend the heart of God any more than they already have. Yet none are too far gone. None. So he stands up and he says, what you have worshipped in ignorance, you didn't know, but you're trying to cover all your bases. Let me tell you what that is. And then he speaks with authority. And I'm really going to sum this up. So if you want some homework today, you can just read the last 10 verses on your own. And if you have questions, you come see me tonight, and I will do my best to answer them. But he says, look, here's the difference. The God that I serve is not like your gods. This is the Giesemann summation translation, all right? The God I serve is not like your gods. Your gods are made of silver, gold, wood, stone. The sheds, barns, and houses they live in, you build. They need you to service them, to bring them food, drink, and sometimes change their undergarments on the statues. I'm not making this up. That happened from 2,000 years before this that was going on. He said, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob does not need you. But the difference between your gods and my God is that he wants you. In fact, Paul says, God has established the places and times for all men to live with a purpose, so that some would seek him and find him. And he says, and you can know this is true because his son that came and lived and was crucified is not still dead. He is alive. We're told at the end of chapter 17 that two people by name gave their lives to Jesus. A woman named Damaris, who had to be listening on the outside because, don't be mad at me, ladies, I'm sorry, I'm just saying. Women were not allowed in the Areopagus, so she was listening. And a guy named Dionysius. Dionysius went on to become the bishop of Athens. Now, I've given this talk lots of times in many churches, and I've had people that will come up to me with very good intentions afterward, and I'm just trying to avoid an awkward situation now, so we're going to talk about it now, who will come up to me and say, you know, Paul failed in Athens, right? How did he now? Yeah, he failed in Athens, which is actually the position of eminent New Testament theologian F.F. Bruce. F.F. Bruce is wrong. And the logic goes that, well, Paul admitted as much in 1 Corinthians 1. No, he did not. I can walk you through that if you like. But then the kind of final nail is often, well, Paul used man's logic and not God's logic. All right, well, if that is your position, before you make that statement, you need to answer a question for me. What's the difference? Does God have a different math than you? Jesus was the logos. What word comes from logos? Logic. God is not illogical. Belief in Jesus is not illogical. In fact, it makes perfect sense. Very well. And I say that's a win in a pre-Christian society for two people to give their lives to Jesus. I say, amen, I like you. This is good. We can be friends for the next week. I'm worried about that. But we're going to be talking about this whole university experience. And just this morning, I just wanted you to think about how do you see those who are far from God? Are you angry? Are you compassionate? One of my heroes, a philosopher at Western Michigan University, Tim McGrew. Maybe some of you have heard of him. I don't know. He's a chess master. The guy's a genius. It's kind of sick. He's debated famous atheists like a guy named Bart Ehrman and stuff like that. And whenever I'm in Kalamazoo, I sit and I speak with Tim, and he spends time with me. And this guy who, academically speaking, has achieved more than I ever will, and that's not a pity party, it's just truth. You know, it's okay. But I watched this guy weep over his students. When's the last time any of us were heartbroken for a broken world? Instead of raising awareness. Awareness has no causal power, by the way. I can be aware that smoking 10 packs of cigarettes a day is bad for me and still do it. I don't, by the way, Pastor, I'm not. He's got me in a non-smoking room anyway, so, you know, that put a kibosh on that. But are you willing to spend the time and do the work in the name of Jesus to understand your world well enough because you love them enough to explain the gospel to them? That's what we have to do in our universities. Are you willing to do that? Do you know the Epicureans who are your neighbors? Do you know the Stoics who are your neighbors? Do you understand what drives them? Do you know what they believe and why? Furthermore, can you answer why you believe what you believe? I'm going to leave you with a quick benediction, which of course comes from the Latin benedictus, which means to drop the mic. So I'm going to... You never know what you're going to learn. Poor pastor, he's like, what have I done? This guy. So I'm going to leave you with a benediction, and then I'm going to turn it back over to Pastor. There may come a day when Christians are called to abandon the university to itself, its self-worship, its idolatry, and its falsehood. But that is not this day.